Radio Hangar here. Pull up a seat. Let's talk flying. Welcome back to the hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and tonight I want to tell you a story. One of the great ones, maybe the great one. So grab your coffee, settle in, because this one deserves the full telling. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com.
All right.
Let me set the scene for you. It's October 1947, the high desert of Southern California, Muroc Army Airfield, which you know today as Edwards Air Force Base. The air out there is thin and dry, and it smells like sage and dust and AV fuel. The sun hasn't come up yet, and the ground crews are already out on the lakebed, breath hanging in the cold morning air, prepping the strangest-looking airplane most of them have ever seen. She's called the X-1, the Bell. X-1, bright orange, about 31 feet long, stubby little wings, and she looks for all the world like a 50-caliber bullet with a cockpit bolted onto it. That wasn't an accident, by the way. The engineers at Bell Aircraft modeled her shape after the Browning 50-cal round because they knew that bullet was stable in supersonic flight. If it works for a bullet, they figured, maybe it'll work for an airplane? Now here's where it gets interesting. The pilot they picked for this mission was a 24-year-old kid from Hamlin, West Virginia, Captain Charles Elwood Yeager. Chuck to everybody who knew him, and everybody in that desert knew him. Chuck Yeager was not an engineer. He didn't have a college degree. What he had was 18 and a half years of living and about 5 years of flying that would have filled three lifetimes. He'd been an enlisted mechanic first, then flight training, then he went to war. Over Europe, flying P-51 Mustangs, Yeager shot down 13 German aircraft, 13 confirmed. He was shot down himself over France, evaded capture with the help of the French resistance, made it over the Pyrenees into Spain on foot, and then talked his way back into combat when regulations said he shouldn't fly over occupied territory again. He went straight to Eisenhower's office and argued his case. That tells you everything you need to know about Chuck Yeager. But let me back up a minute, because to understand what happened on the morning of October 14th, you have to understand what they were afraid of. See, by the mid-1940s, pilots were dying. Dying in ways that engineers couldn't fully explain, as propeller-driven fighters got faster, and especially as the early jets came along. Pilots would push into high-speed dives, and their aircraft would start to buffet. The controls would lock up or reverse. The airplane would tuck under and go straight in. They called it compressibility. The aerodynamicists talked about shockwaves forming on the wings and tail surfaces, disrupting the airflow, blanking out the control surfaces. They called it the sound barrier, and a lot of serious people, smart people, believed it was a wall. That Mach 1, roughly 761 miles per hour at sea level, was a speed that no airplane and no pilot could survive. The British had tried it. Geoffrey de Havilland Jr., son of the great aircraft designer, was killed in September of 1946 when his de Havilland DH-108 swallow disintegrated in a high-speed dive over the Thames estuary. That shook people badly. So when Chuck Yeager climbed into the X-1 that October morning, there were men on that lakebed who genuinely believed they might be watching a man fly to his death. But here's the thing about Yeager. Two nights before the flight, he'd gone horseback riding with his wife Glennis at a ranch near the base. The horse spooked, threw him, and he hit a fence post, broke two ribs on his right side, two cracked ribs. Now think about that. The X-1's cockpit door had a handle that you had to pull shut and lock from the inside, and it took real force. With two broken ribs on his right side, Yeager couldn't do it. He couldn't close his own cockpit door. Did he tell the brass? Did he scrub the flight? No, sir, he did not, he told one person, his buddy Jack Ridley, the flight engineer. And Ridley, God bless him, went out and found a sawed-off broom handle, about 10 inches long, and showed Yeager how to use it as a lever to pull that door shut with his left hand. A sawed-off broom handle. That's what stood between Chuck Yeager and the sound barrier. That and two cracked ribs and more guts than any 10 men you'll ever meet. The morning of October 14th, they loaded the X-1 into the belly of a modified B-29 Superfortress, the mothership they called it. Yeager climbed down a ladder from the bomb bay into the X-1's cockpit at about 7,000 feet. The cold up there was brutal, his ribs were screaming. He used that broom handle to seal the door. At 20,000 feet they dropped him, he fell away from the B-29, and then he lit the four chambers of that reaction motor's XLR-11 rocket engine one at a time. Each chamber kicked him back in the seat a little harder. The acceleration was savage, nothing like a piston engine, nothing like a jet. This was raw, violent thrust, 12,000 pounds of it, burning alcohol and liquid oxygen. He climbed, pushed through 35,000 feet, pushed through 40,000. The Mach meter was creeping up, 0.88, 0.92, 0.96, and then the buffeting started. The airplane was shaking. The shock waves were forming on the wings and the tail, just like the engineers predicted. The controls got mushy, the nose wanted to pitch, and the conventional elevator was losing authority. but the X1 had a trick up her sleeve. She had a movable horizontal stabilizer instead of relying on the elevator alone. Jaeger could change the angle of the entire tail surface. It was a brand new idea, and it worked. He pushed through 0.98, 0.99.
And then something happened that nobody expected. The buffeting stopped. The ride went smooth, glass smooth. The needle on the Mach meter jumped past 1 and just kept climbing. Later they calculated he hit Mach 1.06, about 700 miles per hour at that altitude. Down on the lake bed, the ground crew heard it, a sound none of them had ever heard before. A double crack like thunder rolling across the desert floor, the first sonic boom any of them had ever experienced. The sound barrier wasn't a wall at all, it was a door, and Chuck Jaeger kicked it wide open. He brought the X1 back down, dead-sticked her to a landing on the lake bed after the fuel ran out, and climbed out of the cockpit with those two broken ribs and a grin that could have lit up the whole Mojave. And then, because this was a classified military program, nobody said a word. The story didn't break publicly until Aviation Week ran it the following June. Jaeger didn't get famous for months. He just went back to work the next day, flying the next mission. You know what gets me about this story? It's not the speed, it's not even the courage, although Lord knows there was plenty of that. It's the quiet way he did it. No fanfare, no press conferences, just a test pilot doing his job, broken ribs and a broom handle, and all. Chuck Jaeger went on to fly the X-1 dozens more times. He eventually hit Mach 2.44 in the X-1A in December of 1953. He commanded squadrons, trained astronauts, flew combat missions in Vietnam. He lived to be 97 years old and never lost that West Virginia twang or that absolute conviction that flying was the greatest thing a human being could do. I had the privilege of hearing him speak once at Oshkosh, years ago. Somebody in the audience asked him if he was scared that morning, and he said something I never forgot. He said, "Scared, no, concerned, sure, but you don't think about the dying part, you think about doing the job right." That's a pilot talking right there, that's what it sounds like. The X-1, by the way, the original, the one that broke the barrier. She's hanging in the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. right now, right next to the Spirit of St. Louis and the Wright Flyer. Jaeger named her Glamorous Glennis, after his wife. You can still see the name painted on the nose, orange as the day she flew. If you ever get to Washington, go stand under her. Look up at that little cockpit. Think about a 24-year-old kid from West Virginia with two broken ribs and a sawed-off broom handle. And then tell me flying isn't magic. That's the hangar for tonight, friends. Sources for this story come from the Air Force Flight Test Center Historical Archives, Jaeger's own autobiography co-written with Leo Janos, and the Smithsonian's collection records. As always, Radio Hangar is an AI-generated broadcast, built by people who love airplanes. You can learn more and find every episode at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Go fly something this week. Even if it's just your imagination, Radio Hangar, keep the blue side up.